I'm John Kroll. Today we have a special No Limits. We're going to have a conversation, an intimate conversation, with Hoosier writers James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom about their life and work. This is a recorded program. That means that we won't be able to take calls, emails, or questions via social media. But we do hope that you will enjoy this conversation, James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We've got a special pre-recorded show for you today. We're going to be talking with Indiana writers James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom about their lives and art. Because this is a recorded program, we won't be taking calls, emails, or messages via social media. We think you're going to enjoy the conversation. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's good to see you.
It's good to have both of you here. So I'm gonna start by asking what is a simple question, but it's never an easy answer. Why do you write?
Why do I write? Because we have this wonderful language that you can do things with. And I find that writing is simply a way to express what's into myself or what's in myself and then hoping that there'll be some response from out there. And there always has been. So I just kept it up because of a good response, I guess.
Dark Rain, how about you? What do you write?
I know some stories that are true as far as people repeat what they have done away from home. And I wrote a Shawnee history book that included 500 years of oral tradition validated by at least one or two other tribes, and then 500 years of exposure to the white man. And then I wrote another one that basically Warrior Woman was my idea, my contract, until his publisher wanted to do it and pay a little better. And it's just things that nobody today seems to know or understand, not just politically, but personally, interpersonally. And now I've been working on one from my family. And my grandfather's life was extraordinary for a kid that left when he was in second grade. Mm-hmm. He basically traveled the world. He went to everywhere but Africa. And he did it as a camp boy for the Marines. Ran away from home. Dad was murdered when he's three. He ran away from home when he was six. Celebrated his eighth birthday out in California. Worked on the docks. He was a small man. And, you know, used to, we didn't have so much pasteboard or cardboard. So he found a wooden shipping crate. And as tiny as he was, that was a perfect living room or bedroom for him. And he came in from the docks one night, and it was raining, and a drunk had found his little room. So he just went back to the docks and got on one of the ships under the canvas, because even though when they went to motors, they supplemented with canvas. And when he woke up, they were out to sea. And it was a military troop ship that dropped him in China during the Boxer Rebellion.
Oh, wow.
Because it was a military ship, he couldn't work his way back. And so the camp, the Marines adopted him, and he was their camp boy until he was 16. Then he joined the Army for real, and he was out less than 3 weeks when World War I broke out. And he helped build a town in less than 2 weeks that housed 8,000 people, military.
Now, both of you have developed reputations, obviously, as writers of previous periods, historical novelists, mm-hmm. but it's not necessarily the term I would use, because the people who live in your books don't think of themselves as living in the past. It was the present to them. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the joy for both of you, is uncovering those moments in the past and making clear life was every bit as complex? And Jim, I'll start with you.
Yes, there's that. But I grew up, I was fortunate. I grew up with parents who were aware of the tradition, where we fit in American history. Both of them had been here in the colonial times, you know. Revolutionary War soldiers, and my mother's people were Nantucket whalers, so their names were in Moby Dick, you know. So I was always aware of where I was in history. So when it came time to write a book, I never really intended to write historical novels, but when the U.S. Bicentennial was coming up, somebody at the Historical Society suggested that I might dramatize George Rogers Clark's life. And once I wrote that book, which was Long Knife, and I started getting the feedback, I realized this might be my genre. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, Random House wouldn't let me do anything else because I was making money for them.
Funny how and, that.
But each story was incredible, and we knew where it fit into the development of the country and so forth. And I heard that people were not only enjoying the stories of these people, but they were learning things that they had not known about American history. And so that was satisfying in a couple of ways, and it made me happy to stay in the genre. And of course, now some things that I've written that were contemporary at the time are historical. I'm that old. So. But I wondered if I would ever live long enough to catch up with the Civil War mm-hmm. and write about Lincoln, because he's my favorite American. Mm-hmm. And I finally got a chance to write about him. He's the main character in a novel, even though he's dead when it starts. So, mm-hmm. So I worked my way up that far, and if I live long enough, I might catch up with my own war.
Well, you started, though. I mean, your first two novels were more contemporary, right? Spectator Sport and Staying Out of Hell.
Oh, yes. You remember the titles.
I do. Yeah. I do. I read them.
They were contemporary, absolutely. But, of course, the Korean War is history now.
Yeah.
And that particular race, even though that was written just a few years after it, it was almost like researching history, because I had to have so much right because there were still so many eyewitnesses alive, you know. That's one of our jokes we have in the history profession is, okay, the last eyewitness is dead. Now we can tell it the way we believe it was. But it's been fun. One of the things that I know a few good historical novelists, but primarily I've run into some very good historians and learned how hard they work and their attitudes of what is the accepted truth at any particular time, you know. And that changes all the time. I did a book called Once Upon a Time, It Was Now. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but
no.
It was a kind of a textbook memoir. It was about writing historical novels in such a way that you're telling a story that draws people in, whether they like history or not. Mm-hmm. You get them involved with the people. They learn history, and that gives you the responsibility to be accurate, as a historian is, you see. So you can put fictional characters in a book, but they can't change the actual history.
No, and I remember hearing once the writer David McCullough saying that the key to writing history well, is understanding that the people who are inhabiting your story do not realize they are living in the past.
That's right.
For them, this is simply life, and they are living it and moving through it. Is that in the story you're working on right now, Dark Rain, about your grandfather?
Right.
Is it difficult to reconstruct his experiences? Because I'm assuming that's got to be what Boxer Rebellion was. What, late 1890s? I think 1898. If I remember
98.
Right. If I remember right. So
it's difficult in this regard. My grandfather had been taught particular manners, and a gentleman never engaged in conversation with any young lady unless a chaperone was present. So he had taught himself to read, and he would read literally the old dime crime stories.
Yeah.
And when we would come in, we lived about 100 miles away. My mom would go to the kitchen and help Grandma. My dad had things that he wanted to do outside, places he wanted to go. And that left Grandpa and I. And he taught me nothing. But my cousins, my boy cousins, got to hear all the stories of his life. When he and Grandma were first married after World War I, she was known as a fabulous cook, and he was known as a fabulous storyteller. So they might have 20 people coming in Sunday just to be entertained and fed for free.
Yeah.
So I had to interview a bunch of my cousins. And then I got the man who, when his mother remarried after his father was murdered, that man hated him with a passion, him and his brother, and tried to shoot him and kill him. And so they went to somebody else's house to stay. Well, when Grandpa came back, you're looking at a community that never went as far as 6.5 miles to Chillicothe. And so when he came back, got off of the train that he hopped, and he starts telling them these stories, and they're so wild, they can't believe it. They think he's nuts. And then he really started telling them stories, and they thought, this man has really lost it. First of all, they thought he was a ghost because he'd been gone for 5 years.
Yeah.
So you got a ghost, you got a crazy person, and then they found out that he was an alcoholic and was just a drunk, and so they dismissed him. And he had no place to go, and this family let him stay in the barn because his mother had been a herbalist and fixed the family up. And I got to speak to that gentleman who owned the barn. And it was wonderful to get to do that and hear how the people in the community felt about my ancestor. And I grew up without plumbing. Part of my life, we didn't even have lights. We had kerosene lamps. So reconstructing his life as it was not very difficult for me at all. But I did get to interview him once, and he was a character.
How long has he been gone now?
Oh, gosh. I was about 30.
Okay.
Oh, 75, so about 45 years.
45 years. So he died in the early 1970s then.
Yeah.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with the noted Hoosier authors, James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom. They're responsible for some of the best-loved books in the Indiana canon right now, including Panther in the Sky, Follow the River, Warrior Woman, too many other books for me to mention because, among other things, they're both very, very prolific. This is a recorded program, so that means that we are not able to take calls, emails, or messages via social media, but we do hope you are enjoying the conversation. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today with the Hoosier writers James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom. This is a pre-recorded show, which means we're not going to be able to take calls, emails, or messages via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the pleasures of sort of attempting to and challenges of reconstructing the past. Jim, I'm going to throw this one because one of the legends about you mm-hmm. is obviously the research that you did to write the book Follow the River.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about how you reconstructed that story and probably tell people, if you could, a synopsis of what the story is about?
Well,
without denying them the pleasure of reading the book.
It was a captivity story. It took place in 1755 in the French and Indian War. And the woman escaped from the Shawnee Indians. And just by following what she remembered of the kidnapping route, she made her way across the Alleghenies back to Virginia, the first white woman to cross that section. And because it had so few characters in it, it had her and an old woman that was with her, another captive, and the people they were trying to get home to, the main force and the main character in the book was the Allegheny Mountains. And so in order to write something that would have been just a survival annal, the power of nature, the obstacles they had, provided a lot of the dramatic tension that a book like that wouldn't have. But since they were white people and had not grown up as the Indians there, they did not know what was, you know, how to survive easily and what was good to eat and so forth. So the drama came from the conflict between them and this enormous, beautiful, magnificent, terrible countryside. And I knew that in order to describe it, I'd have to go through it. And so as much as I could, I was teaching at IU at the time, so I couldn't go for 43 days. But every time I had a few days, I would go a little farther along her trail. And I would do a few things to be able to describe the effects of hunger, for example, and exhaustion. I fasted for quite a while to see not just how it affected me physically, but mentally too. And it has a bigger effect mentally than... one of the things I found out was that what worms taste like and stuff like that. And when I met Dark Rain, she said, well, at least he'll never complain about my cooking.
And he doesn't.
Nothing to complain about. But anyway, you have to go through some of these things to be able to describe them well enough to put the reader back there. See, that's my key. I don't, like a historian, say something happened 200 years ago. I say we are now in 1755 and something's about to happen. We don't know how it's going to turn out. And that way you can tell the story with some suspense. But in order to do that, you have to write to their senses. You have to make them hungry. You have to make them be able to hear the water and the thunder and the just the enormity of the world that they were passing through. Mm-hmm. And the hunger and the cold and all that. So the best comment I ever get from my fans, as far as I'm concerned, mm-hmm. is I felt like I was there. Mm-hmm. Because that's what I try to do. That way they forget that they know how it came out, because the history books aren't written yet, see. And the way it turns out, of course, is they're all dead now. But during the time that you're reading the story, they're not only alive, but you're there with them. And I just kind of fell into that instinctively. I didn't have enough sense to figure that out, but it worked that way, and that's been the one reason why some of my books are still out there after 35 or 40 years, you know.
I remember talking with the writer E.L. Doctorow once, who said that he would write a book in part because there was a lesson he had to learn.
Yeah.
Something that, you know, he had to be revealed to him, and the only way he could get at it was by doing that. Start by asking if both of you agree with that, and if so, Dark Reign, what are some of the lessons that your books have taught you, the process of writing them or working through them?
That's hard. Nobody's ever asked me that one before, John.
I try to be distinctive when I can.
For one thing, the characters take over.
The characters tell the story.
He said that, too. That,
I started with Warrior Woman because as a little girl, I had not too many people to be a heroine and try to emulate. We had Eleanor Roosevelt, Helen Keller, Clara Barton. Red Cross was already created. I was born with better health than Helen Keller, and I never would marry a president. But there was an Indian woman that was a chief and a warrior. And she was, as I researched her more than I knew about her, I had not realized how politically active she was and how world famous she was during her lifetime. And the more I found about her, the more fascinating she and her lifetime became. And she was over 6 feet tall, about 6'6", drop-dead gorgeous, did all the dumb things beautiful women usually do. But she was so instrumental in so many of the treaties being signed between the English and the Indians and the Americans and the Indians, that she had to be a very impressive speaker and convincer to her brothers who were chiefs, cousins who were chiefs. She came from the super line of chiefs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the White House's tops. She came from the top tier of chiefs. And the more I found out about what everybody else knew about her during that period of time and what they thought her value was, it was very intriguing. And then I discovered this missionary, a Moravian missionary, and he came to America. His parents just left him in Europe, and 2 years later, he got a passage over to America, and he was following their lead to be missionaries, and they didn't want him. Mm-hmm. The community just said, nuh-uh. And he said, okay, let me go and teach Christianity to the Western Indians. Now, the Western Indians were west of the Alleghenies and certainly west of the Ohio. So the governor of Pennsylvania said, okay, but I want you to send me reports. Anytime any of the tribes come through, you tell me who they are, where they're from, what they talked about, where they were going. And I want daily reports and a monthly report. And if I don't get those, I will pull you back out. So unknown to the tribal people and the other white people, he was a spy. And he would preach. And the Indians had warm hearts to the story of Christ being murdered. And they would weep, and then he would say, his death is on your hands, this wonderful man, and you're guilty. You have to come and be redeemed. And they would come, and they would feel like they were doing what was needed to be redeemed and be whole. And he'd say, well, it's not really sealed until we see how you live for a few years and then I'll baptize you, and then you'll be done. He might make them wait 6 years and make them weep all the time. And when I started the book, I referred to him as Brother Zeisberger, the missionary, and then I wrote the missionary Zeisberger, and then I wrote the Zeisberger. Mm-hmm. The editor called and said, "Dark Rain, you got to make up your mind what you're going to call this guy." Mm-hmm. And I said, "The more I researched him, the less I liked him." And so, in the end, it came to pass that in his diaries, his own that nobody else saw, he wrote how it killed his very soul to waste one sacred drop of Christ's blood on these creatures that were more vile than animals. He was supposed to marry a convert. All of the missionaries had to marry a convert. And after 50 years, he was still single. And they sent him back to Bethlehem, PA, and said, you marry one, or we're not going to let you go back. You're too old. You need somebody to take care of you. He went around the corner to the Lutheran headquarters and for about a month courted that guy's daughter and married her and took her back. So he never did marry a convert, but he was their boss. Oh, he was a sly devil. And the more you research, the more it finds you, the things you find that you didn't know.
The complexity of the past is there. Jim, in speaking to the sort of doctoral thing about learning a lesson, I think I have enjoyed all of your books, but I would be less than honest if I didn't say that the one that spoke to me the most powerfully was Panther in the Sky.
Okay.
Because of the spiritual component and a lot of what I thought I read, accurately or not, was a sense of spiritual discovery in the author's part, too, that there was an awakening that was taking place behind the page, too.
Yeah, you're an awfully perceptive guy, because that's true. When I started out, I had been writing about the frontier from the white man's point of view and all that, but I had come to think, what was it that made it possible for these different tribes, particularly the Shawnee, to resist so powerfully and so strongly for so long against the odds? And I finally realized that I was only telling half the story if I didn't try to tell it from it. But I also had this feeling that I'm not sure I can do that because I've never been in another culture. And there were things about foretelling the future and beliefs of the world system that I didn't even know about. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to learn an awful lot before I even know that I can do the book. And it turned out that as I did find Dark Rain's people, and they began to let me in to their ceremonies and confidences and so forth, and I found myself suddenly in a belief system that made sense to me for the first time in my whole life. Here was a people who believed that anything that had life was sacred because God had given it life.
Mm-hmm.
Not just man, but all the other creatures and all the other living things were sacred. And that's way back in my soul someplace, I had always thought that must be true. If you've been given life, then you're blessed. And so I was so comfortable with these people, and they were not only teaching me things, but they were making me spiritually healthier because I had been awfully tight and wound up about a lot of things. But they basically saved my life by calming me down. And then they let me marry their best woman, and she's been taking care of me that way ever since. So I did not really know whether I could write anything that had to do with prophecies and so forth, because I didn't think I understood them. But when I met the chief, the first time I met him, he was very skeptical about another white man coming to write about Tecumseh. But he asked me, I told him, I'm not here to find out about the Shawnee silver mines or Tecumseh's love life. What I want to do is find out the spiritual condition that your people were in during this crisis period. And he said, well, I told him, I'm not sure that I can even comprehend the prophecy parts of it. Okay. And he said, well, have you ever had anything supernatural happen to you? And I said, well, I was a newspaper man, and I only believed what I read or saw, you know. But I said, not long ago, I said, something happened out on the highway where I foresaw something, and it made me slow down, and there it was a minute later, and I saved my life that way. And so it was like a veil came off his eyes, and he said, well, you're being saved for something. And he said, come and spend time with us, and we'll try to teach you.
I know we're getting close on time, but was it difficult to cross that kind of cultural divide? Because we're a culture, you know, most of us who are of European extraction are taught to think of and conditioned to think of Native Americans as the other in our cultural experience.
Well, we have stolen so much of not only their land and everything, but their culture. And so they're reluctant.
Yeah.
But when they found out that I wasn't pushing them for things, and they let me come in and learn at my own pace and with my own sincerity, it was like I was in a family, you know.
Yeah.
And they did adopt me. So I didn't try to push my way in.
Yeah.
Some authors have tried to do that, and they don't get good information.
Yeah.
You see. But if they draw you in because they want to, then you can learn to the point that you actually think in harmony with them. It was a great thing. It was the best, you know, the years I've been with the Indians for about 40 years now, and it's been the best part of my life, the best half of my life. There's nothing to compare with it.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with the Hoosier writers James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom about their life and work. This is a recorded program, so we're not taking calls, emails, or messages via social media. But we do hope you are enjoying the conversation. We will be back with live shows, we promise, at some point. In the meantime, I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today in a pre-recorded conversation with Hoosier writers James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom, two of the best-loved authors in the state. Because this is a recorded program, we can't take calls, emails, or messages via social media. Do hope, though, that you are enjoying the conversation. So we are coming up on the 10th anniversary of the passing of a man that we were, all three of us were fortunate to know and to consider a friend, the late Kurt Vonnegut, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, Indiana writer of all time. Given that this occasion is coming up, would you care to share a memory or two of Kurt? I'll start with you, but I want to hear Dark Rain, because I know Dark Rain counseled him actually at one point.
Oh yeah, the first night she met Kurt was a memorable time anyway. But so we'd known him since '92, but I want to thank you for the fact that I got to know him better. And that was because he was supposed to come out and speak to the Indiana Civil Liberties Union. Mm-hmm. And he got sick, and so you, for some reason, thought I could...
You were gracious enough to step in and help us, yes. So
I went up and I gave the speech, as I thought he might have tried to do, about the things that he might have wanted to talk about, which was the attack on the human, you know, American civil rights and stuff in 2002, I think it was. But I also wanted to treat it with humor, mm-hmm. like him. So I wrote a speech and gave it that night. And Kurt read it later, and he liked it, and he gave me a call. And so then we sort of took up the cause of the anti-Iraq war and so forth. And another great thing that came out of that was, in addition to the time that we spent mostly just by phone, because he lived in New York. But he also, he liked to share things that he thought were good with other people. And so he put me in touch with Howard Zinn.
Mm-hmm.
And he became an old friend, too. And it was like, I felt like I was in the best company in the world at a time when the world needed somebody to say, don't go to war.
Yeah.
You know. And those two guys had been through it. And so they knew how stupid it was to do that. So we had a few years together, and of course Kurt died, and then Howard died. But we got to know them both pretty well, and it was just like having all of a sudden, late in your life, getting your best two uncles that show up. You know, they were wonderful people.
Dark Rain.
Jim and I talked about authors and stories and things. We had only been married about 2 years, and we went to this program where they were honoring Kurt and other writers, and I had not yet read anything of his,
mm-hmm.
but I trusted Jim's opinion that he was a great writer, and we had a dinner, about a dozen of us, before the program. And Jim was on my right, and Kurt was on my left. And we tried to make conversation. Well, if I started, he didn't know anything about it. Whatever he started to talk about, I knew nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
So it got kind of quiet, and then he said, you know, I've written a lot of books, and I think I'm just out of things to say. And I don't want to write anymore. I've got nothing left, and I might as well just go ahead and commit suicide and get it over with. Well, suicide is something you don't talk to me about in that manner.
Yeah.
And for about 20 minutes, he got a silent chewing.
Did he accept it with grace?
Oh, he did.
Okay.
And we were friends from then on. But I just made him realize what he would do to the people he loved that he left behind. And he would be in no way to calm them or soothe them or anything. It would just be a horror that he would leave them with. And he didn't want to do that. He loved his kids. And so we were friends. He'd call. I was answering the phone because Jim was in the middle of a book. And it was delightful. We went to New York and were supposed to see him, and one of his kids was having a problem out on Long Island, and he had to call and break our dinner date.
Yeah.
And so we didn't get to see him after that one night, but we did. Well, we did. We saw him when he came to IU to speak. But that was our last socialization in person. But our hearts grew fonder of each other, and we've been blessed to know his children, and Nanny has come and spent a couple of days with us in the night in our little log cabin, and she is just as winsome a person. She is sheer fay delight.
Everybody in that family can write like crazy. They're all good.
It's almost like, you know, genetic or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
Some huge talent. What do you think his now that we have the beginnings of some distance on his life and career, what do you think Kurt's legacy is?
Well, there's so much there, it's hard to distill a single legacy out of it. But one of the things is that I think is a basic plea for kindness and not – one of the things that I loved about him was that he hated anybody who could rationalize easy killing of other people mm-hmm. and stuff like that.
Or cruelty of any kind, and, really.
And I always felt we were closest when we were being pacifists. I think that's an important thing. But on the other hand, he had a way of expanding your mind so that you never looked at time in the same way again. You never saw time as just a linear projection from A to B, you know, because it meant everything and all the meaning was in it, and you could be in it in any way your spirit would let you. That's about as well as I can put
it. Yeah, I used to tell people, because I would get together for dinner with him in New York, dinner or lunch, mm-hmm. and he was such a creature of habit. Mm-hmm. You know, he was almost always wearing the same thing when I saw him. It would be a sort of a faded blue dress shirt and a yeah. blue sweater over it, and uh-huh. his tennis shoes and some khaki slacks, and
yeah.
he would, if it was lunch, we would eat at the Italian place that was just up from his place in Midtown, or dinner, it was the French place.
Yeah.
But people would ask me about it when I'd come back, and I'd say, well, you know, when you talk with Kurt, it's like looking at life through a different lens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're seeing the same things, but you see them in a different way. His mm-hmm. one of his gifts was forcing you to look at something you thought you knew mm-hmm. from an entirely different angle, or just shift it into a different focus.
Yeah.
So,
one of the things that I've learned from knowing Nanny, mm-hmm. his daughter, she said that he worked so hard and worked in such vast, exploring ways just to keep himself from going nuts.
Mm-hmm.
Because his experience in World War II was enough to skew him forever. So through the writing, and then later on through his printmaking and artistry, have you seen his book of art?
Yeah.
She said he did both of these things to keep himself sane. And since my mother was a psychiatrist, I know that we're all a little bit crazy in one way or another, you know. And, but that's a part of it. He's expanded the, to me, the acceptable limits of sanity, mm-hmm. you know. And if you can do that, that's an awfully good service for mankind.
Yes. Dark Rain, what do you think his legacy is?
Well, I think bravery is not loud. It's very quiet. And some of the people that are the bravest, you never hear the horror they've gone through. Mm-hmm. And they know that they have responsibilities yet to somebody, and so they stay and deal with it. But one week, I guess it was the week that he came and spoke at IU, and in the same week on television, Desmond Tutu spoke. And the same week, the Dalai Lama came and spoke. And they all ended their speeches with, "It makes no difference what other people are doing. You be kind." Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel.
Yeah.
And to hear it from those three wonderful men really made an impression on me, and I was so glad to know that he felt that way.
Kurt obviously is one of those folks who looms large over Indiana's history and culture, and American culture, and really the world. I mean, we know as writers the fact that he's been dead for 10 years and all of his books are still in print is a sign of a tremendous achievement. I'm just curious, was he one of the writers before you got to know him who influenced you?
Yes, I started reading him when he first came out with the books that came to notice, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was aware. See, I grew up on Mark Twain, mm-hmm. and so did he. And so he was almost like an intermediary that that kept Twain going, and helped project that almost limitless sense of absurdity and humor, you know, mm-hmm. that is in life. And I think that's why I was so receptive to him in the first place, was because I realized that he had real good BS filters.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh,
yeah. And I had, having been a newspaper man, I knew you really need those.
Yeah.
You know. But that was, it was just like, if I could ever say that I had left anybody with some of the messages or some, even just some of the feelings mm-hmm. that Kurt and Mark Twain left people with, I would die happy, you know. Mm-hmm. And Kurt was very important, and he always will be here because young people respond to him even though he's dead now.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
And it's odd. He did that even though he made no attempt mm-hmm. at all to attempt to be current. You
right.
know, I mean, to pretend that he was anything other than what he was, yeah. which at least at the time I knew him was a man in his late 70s or early 80s.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a – down at the Lilly Library, mm-hmm. Dan Wakefield discovered all his – short stories, I guess, and
yeah.
that's going to be coming out as a book. And I'm really looking forward to that because most of the magazines that those stories were in mm-hmm. have been defunct for decades now.
Oh, yeah.
And most of those stories I haven't read. I've only read the novels. Mm-hmm. So I just can't wait, you know. And you love somebody's writing that much, you hate it when they die.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you find out, hey, there's still something he did that I haven't read yet, see?
Do you enjoy, with other writers, I'm asking both of you here since you've done this, I mean, a lot of the short stories, he would say that was sort of my apprenticeship. I was figuring it out at that
sure.
point, trying to figure. Do you enjoy sort of tracing the development of another writer? Do you find that helpful in you know, the creation of your own work? Dark Rain, I'll start with you because I can see Jim's mulling on this a little bit. I wanted to see.
Well, it's delightful when someone comes to us and says, I want to write a book.
Yeah.
Or I've started writing a book and I'd like to just talk it over with you. And they will eventually get around to whatever it was that they was really bugging them or stopping them. And so it's wonderful when we can have conversations with them if they're stumped or if the story's going where they didn't want it to go. We can always say, that's great because your characters will now tell you the truth to put down on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And we do. We enjoy talking with others. We've got several friends that have sold multiple books and they're very successful. And it's just great to see them getting into real life and bringing those quantities out and telling those great stories.
Jim?
We still have several people that we're currently talk literature with all the time. And I have a friend, Dick Cady, here in Indianapolis.
Oh, yeah. I
got to the Civil War, and I wrote this book, and I sent him the manuscript because I like him to vet things. He's got real, real good
yeah.
judgment. And he read the thing, and he said, well, what you need to do, he said, you need to put in more sex. And he said, you need to retitle it 50 Shades of Blue and Gray. So I didn't do that, but I did put in more sex. And you remember, that censorship flap up?
Oh, in Noblesville,
where the CLU came in.
Yeah.
This new book has it deals with soldiers, and so it's got an awful lot of raunchy stuff in it.
Yeah.
So we may be doing that again sometime. I don't know. But
all the mothers who have had their sons be soldiers are going to be aghast.
Yeah.
Well, I'm afraid that's probably going to have to be the last word. We've come to the end of our time, unfortunately. But I would like to thank both of you, James Alexander Tom and Dark Rain Tom, for what's been, as always, a fascinating conversation.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be
here.
It always does. It always does. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.